another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. One of the things that we often sort of don't acknowledge, even though we're surrounded by these things, is how much information, media, books, texts, magazines inform our most personal and subjective explorations of the world. And this is particularly true if you like, for a moment, if you're even able to anymore. I know sometimes I can't imagine a world without the internet. And particularly imagine sort of the last great awakening of occult, metaphysical, and spiritual ideas in the 1960s and 70s. And people try to account for this, and they're like, why did this happen at this point? Was it, you know, social dynamics? Was it the emergence of a psychedelic culture? Was it dissatisfaction with Christianity, et cetera, et cetera? There's all these different kind of reasons that people try to explain why this happened. And one very important aspect of this whole world was simply that there were certain books around. And then those books became popular, and so then more books became around. And then as there were more books that people could read about all of these traditions, read about these practices, read about the personal adventures that individuals have gone through, bring older books back into print that sort of resonate with this emerging ethos, that became kind of the nurturing ground for a lot of people's experiences, a lot of people's thoughts, so that you can really trace sort of the emergence of a lot of alternative ideas, health practices, spiritual traditions, new spiritual developments, questions in consciousness, the sort of growth of increasingly, one could call them conspiracies or sort of alternative histories, through the waxing and waning of publishing houses, and even to the point at which you can find sort of, you know, you can read pulp fiction from the 1920s and 1930s, and you can see sort of elements that are going to get picked up and elaborated in cultural practice later on when those, you know, works get republished, like Weird Fiction is a great example of that, or early fantasy books. How much did The Lord of the Rings help influence the emergence of a kind of hippie, organic, nature-loving aesthetic in the United States in the 1960s. So these kinds of questions. So it's really interesting to pay attention to the publishers, pay attention to the people who are putting books out. Of course, things are very different now with the internet, but in some ways we can look back at the history of popular publishing as a way to understand how this whole cone of cultures or these set of cultures develop. And so I'm really happy today that we're going to have a very interesting fellow from Inner Traditions join us, John Graham. He's the acquisitions editor there. And Inner Traditions is one of, you know, the most important of these all sort of alternative but very successful, certainly at some points in its career, publishers of this kind of alternative material, holistic medicine, self-help, alternative history, Asian philosophy, and particularly more recently has become the most important publisher, at least in the United States, but possibly the world, for books dealing with entheogens, and both bringing material back into print and producing quite, actually, what sometimes resembles a flood of new books on the matter. So it's a very, I'm really looking forward to talking to John about the publishing, but also his own career as a fan and translator of surrealist materials, and really getting his sort of take on this emerging culture. Before we do that, we'll bring on our co-host here, Maja Dawu. Maja, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Eric?
Pretty good. And you met John already because he's working on your new book, right?
I've been like showing him some peeks and stuff like that. And I met him. I was lucky enough to meet him through our friend Jody, actually. and have since been chit-chatting with him. He's just like a wealth of information, and just nonstop amazing stuff comes out of his mouth. So he's one of my favorites, yeah.
Do you want to talk about your new book, or do you want to keep that on hold for the moment?
Oh, well, I've been working on one about eating and food that you can eat and what people eat in order to live forever. You know, stuff like ambrosia or the Philosopher's Stone and all the crazy elixirs and cannibalism and all that kind of fun stuff.
So kind of the more like mythical and anthropological element of eating, not so much for nutrition or just sort of, you know, living, but the kind of the more imaginal side of it.
Exactly, yes. Symbolic eating.
Symbolic eating, that's an awesome... That's an awesome. What do you eat that's symbolic? What's the thing that you eat that's like the most like big, like layered with that kind of symbolic?
You know, it's funny. I do a lot of ritual eating. I mean, I have done a lot of communions. Like even in my big public rituals, I'll hold communions because I think the Eucharist is a very important ritual that a lot of people just kind of don't think about at all when they go to church. But it's actually a really big deal. So I'll do ritualistic eating with booze. A lot of times I'll use alcohol as the substance because it's spirits, you know. A lot of people forget about that. Or wine, or all kinds of different... I've had dirt involved, you know, ashes, things like that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to remember, too, because... We think, especially when if you want to talk about entheogens or psychoactives, even just talking about wine, that, you know, in our kind of science-based culture, we think, oh, you know, the wine has certain alkaloids which produce certain effects in the nervous system, and that's why it becomes, you know, can be useful for religious rituals or, you know, in the same kinds of ideas we can extend to other things. And that's, you know, partly true, but it is also true that there's this whole symbolic level, this ritual level that interacts with the psychoactivity, and that in many ways it's that interaction that really sets in motion
exactly
the processes that we're interested in, and so it's good to pay attention to that other level, because I think it's very easy, particularly with food, to go to this kind of, you know, BS science level. Well, it's all about nutrients, and it's no longer a symbolic practice, it's no longer a collective performance, it's just this sort of ingestion of, you know, little molecules that do X and Y to your to your body and your nervous system.
Yeah, it's gotten pretty ridiculous, in my opinion.
Well, as with many things, so maybe hopefully helping us guide our way through the ridiculousness. John Graham, thanks for being on Expanding Mind.
Hello, hi, Eric, Masha, great to talk to you again.
Wonderful, wonderful. So just to start out, I know there's a lot of things we can talk about, but I'd love to hear a little bit about how you see the sort of mission of Inner Traditions and even sort of your role there, you know, as an acquisitions editor, with the kinds of things you're looking for, how you see the sort of, I mean, it's been around for so long, so really, you know, if people looked on their shelves, they'd realize how many kind of pivotal books, not just books that sold well, but really kind of changed people's minds, opened up new spaces, you know, came out of the press. And I'm just kind of curious how you see your role and how you see the role of the press as we're going forward into this very different publishing era.
Well, we're over 35 years old now, so we've been around quite a bit. And, you know, when I came in, it was about 16 years ago, and we'd already been a landmark publisher. We were the first ones to publish aromatherapy books before anybody's heard of it. And that's sort of been my own motivation, is to find things that you just can't find here, or you can't find in the perspective that I like to see. Part of that goes back to my own earlier days working as a surrealist, because it's a kind of consciousness that once you embrace it, it never lets go. And that sort of played into it. And just to be clear, I see surrealism as part of the long Gnostic the heresy that originated in Gnosis and has traveled through the centuries sort of as the counterpart to the Orthodox Christian culture that we live in. And surrealism was part of it, what they would have called a prehensile tale, perhaps. And then surrealism remanifested in the 60s. Well, that's when I first found it, was people were reading a surrealist manifesto and things by Breton and they were using that to reformulate their approach, their feelings about society, their feelings about what we needed to do to get over the obstacles of the status quo.
Well, and that's a really important thing to talk about, I think, because a lot of people don't know that link between surrealism and gnosis. I mean, a lot of people, when they think about surrealism, they just think of a kooky dream images, and maybe there was some drug-related stuff happening there. But, like, for me, I know when I started researching alchemy, I kept, like, getting sent to all these surrealist stuff, like Salvador Dali did, like, a huge alchemical thing. And a lot of people don't realize that there is that connection there. So when you say that surrealism for you had to do with that gnosis and kind of how that formulated your interest in this stuff, I mean, how did that happen for you? How did surrealism and those kind of Gnostic ideas tie together when you kind of got introduced to it?
Well, one thing you have to understand about surrealism is that surrealism has become a journalistic word, surreal, to describe any situation, usually appalling. And what it really comes from is it's a term for higher consciousness, really, to make it simplify it as much as possible. The idea with surreality was to raise yourself above ordinary reality, not for the purpose of denying it, but to see the hidden connections that you can't see when you're embedded in it. Mm. And that's, you know, that was something they picked up from Rambo, and that is one of the things that knowing that has been a guiding force in the way I look at the manuscripts that come to us and the books that I go looking for. I go to France quite a bit, and we do quite a number of translations. And France is, frankly, a goldmine for esoteric and hermetic books. And when I lived there and became friends with a number of people that had been members of the French Surrealist group, I also went to Czechoslovakia. I stayed at the filmmaker Jan Svankmajer's house and met the Czech Surrealist group, which is still as vital and flourishing as ever. And when I actually started talking with people, I saw a much more profound embrace of esoteric tradition than you will find in the art history books.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask a question about that. I've always been curious about that, because I know that particularly later on, both in terms of Breton's own evolution and his changing ideas about religion and politics as well, but also a lot of the groups that kind of carried the torch into the 40s and 50s and into the second half of the 20th century, that esotericism was very strongly pronounced.
Oh, and very much so. It really started in the 30s. There was a doctor named Pierre Mabie, who was Breton's family physician, but he was also a font of information about esoteric traditions, especially alchemy, Nostradamus, astrology, and this was at a time when nobody really knew about this stuff. And the magazine Minotaur, published by Skira, was one of the first mainstream, so to speak, publications that started presenting this stuff to an audience that normally wouldn't see it. And Pierre Mabie is especially interesting. He's a very important surrealist figure that you've never heard of. When he delivered O Breton, who was the daughter of Jacqueline Lamba and André Breton, the next day he came over and did her chart. You know, he was completely involved in the esoteric aspects, and he saw surrealism, much as I do, as part of this long amorous heresy that's been the counterpoint to the orthodox religious values.
Well, I love that phrase, amorous heresy. I want to come back to that. But the question I have for you in asking this about the where the esotericism comes in with surrealism, particularly earlier, is that it seems that along with a kind of esoteric or alchemical impulse or an interest in these materials, or even more, an interest in practices that derange the senses. So it wasn't that the surrealists were just, you know, trying to like trip out in their heads. They developed an elaborate, you know, menagerie of games, techniques, strategies in order to you know, sort of dethrone ordinary daily consciousness and
allow
something
else to
happen. But my question is, like, isn't there something in surrealism, and indeed part of what's important about surrealism is that it's not just an esoteric return, it's that there's some other element or set of elements that are maybe less rooted, like there's an aspect of it that's rooted in tradition or that's drawing from tradition and remaking tradition, but there's another part of it that's very ferociously 20th century, that's very...
Oh, absolutely. And you can see it over and over because their embrace of the esoteric tradition was always on their terms.
Very good.
Gnosis, in the traditional sense, and you see it especially in the Cathars, who really... They believed that the human body was created by an evil demiurge, you know, and that was what the Church of Rome worshipped, this lesser god, this lesser deity named Jehovah, that really didn't understand what, you know, all that went into creation, and humanity was his flawed work. So the idea of reincarnation in the Cathar sense was to keep working through life until you became a perfecti, and then your spirit could rejoin the light and free itself of the muddy dross of the body. The surrealists never did that. I mean, that's one of the reasons the surrealists embrace thought. It's that there's the body, there's no body without ideas, and there's no ideas without a body, it's how Annie Lebrun puts it. And I think that they're very, very clear on, yes, We're esoteric on this level, but we're also atheists. We're not looking for heaven to reward us at some point. We believe these things are the instruments that are the birthright of every individual so that they can make full use of their mind. That's what
I feel like that's what made it, like Eric said, so 20th century, is because they were doing it within themselves on a very personal, physical, you know, not physical materialistic, but literally physical within their flesh, within their mind, within their brain, like literally incorporating their spirit and soul in the body they were in instead of separating it, you know, like those other ideas into some like heaven that's so far away you can't even get there and you have to do all this stuff and then you can only do it when you die and then you can like join the light. But I think the difference is they were just doing it while they were living. They were living these esoteric traditions in themselves, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and in a way, there's an analogy I made once. I remember reading, I think it was Jerry Garcia, was talking about tripping a lot, and it wasn't until he saw the Tibetan Book of the Dead that it had a roadmap for all that territory that had been opened up to him. And the Surrealists had the same type of thing. There was a declaration they made in like the early 20s, or 27 maybe, where they said, you know, we're not making literature, but we're capable of using it like anyone else. But basically, the crux of it was they threw away everything that society had given them and looked deep in their own mind. And as they developed their practice and their theories, they realized that what they were finding matched what was there in the esoteric tradition, the hermetic tradition of Martinism, for example. And they kept coming back to it. And in the 50s, Fulcanelli's descendants were practically full-scale surrealists. René Alot, who's wrote a major book on alchemy, was writing for Medium, which was a surrealist magazine of the 50s, and Eugène Cancellier, who was Fulcanelli's disciple, was working with him constantly, and Bernard Roget, who another alchemist, Jorge Camacho, who is a Cuban surrealist painter, was very much into an operative, he was very much an operative alchemist. In fact, I remember a friend of mine telling me, if he ever wants to sublet your apartment, don't let him because he'll blow it up.
Well, I don't know very much about the later generations you're talking about and the specific connections with esoteric practices, but I want to ask a kind of general question, which is kind of a political question, which is that especially in Europe, that some of the traditions associated with these esoteric traditions, some of the sense of traditionalism, the idea that within these hidden sort of marginal worlds of ideas and practices lies the sort of the truth or spiritual reality, access to spiritual reality, that, that some of that culture is very reactionary politically.
Right.
And of course, surrealism is strongly, at least in its initial expression, marked in the other direction. And it's not just about like where you, who you vote for, whether or not you get on the street for a rally or not. It's almost more, there's something inside too. There's something appealing about the idea that there's a true tradition that was revealed in the past that we have to hold on to in the face of screwed up modernity, that creates a certain kind of conservative ideology that can be very dangerous. I mean, it doesn't have to be, but it can be. And at the same time, with the surrealists as I sort of experience and understand them, there's also this strong insistence on a kind of return to the world that we're in now. Like you say, it's the world, it's in the bodies and minds now. It's not just about recovering and clinging to some ancient tradition. So I'm just curious how in these developments you're talking about through the 40s and 50s and moving forward, when alchemy, very explicitly came to be a major mechanism and model for exploring surrealist impulses, how did that balance between the kind of conservatism of traditionalism versus the kind of radical impulse of the surrealists? How did that balance out? Does that make sense, that question?
Oh yeah, absolutely, and I could go on for 2 hours on answering that one because there's so much involved in that. I mean, initially, the surrealists embraced Leninist communism as the tool they thought as the most likely means for creating the social revolution that would allow the poetic revolution they were advocating to occur. That it would free humanity from all these ridiculous conventions, worn-out morality, everything that had led to World War I, basically, and that the communist revolution was going to be there. But they were never fully communist. There was always... The communists didn't want them, for one thing, not unless they completely wrote off the parts of surrealism that they were not comfortable with, and certain major surrealists like Louis Aragon, Paul Eluard became party members. But there was a major shift on that once the surrealists were among the few French intellectuals on the left that protested the show trials in Moscow in the 30s, and they were giving Victor Serge, who had escaped Russia and was revealing all of this stuff, a warm welcome, whereas, as in most political situations, people were just trying to look the other way, and because they still supported the ideals of the revolution, and these things are bad, but we'll be giving comfort to the real enemy. And the surrealists would have none of that.
Mm.
So they forged a new path, and as a constantly evolving system, André Breton was really wrapped up in trying to figure out why it is that, a great man like Marx should come up with these ideas that would be manifested in a way that had nothing to do with the way he envisioned them. He said, they should be followed by flames, but really they're just followed by great clouds of dust when their followers, follow in pursuit. And there's this idea he had that every idea that triumphs hastens to its ruin.
Mm.
And the last era, the second age of surrealism, post-World War II, was a kind of esoteric balancing act, trying to maintain its presence, its effectiveness, but at the same time not declaring victory.
Right.
Always remaining shy of that so that it would not turn into a caricature of itself.
Yeah, what I think is one of the long-standing strengths of esotericism, even esotericism that tends towards conservative positions that I ultimately find difficult is just because it's still, even after all the publishing and even after the New Age boom and everything, it's still kind of esoteric. And so it rides this line of being, you know, a little too far out, a little bit too. So it still forces the mind into that surrealist kind of space where, like, there's another world that's possible, but it's a world that's tucked inside this world, and it's not that far away, but it still requires you to leap in order to get into it. So it keeps that political, kind of edge to it. But a whole other question for you, in terms of how you see the surrealist impulse continuing on in today, and, you know, through the counterculture and through popular culture, is that some people say, and I think with some reason, that in one way the surrealists did win, or, you know, was that a lot of their techniques and their techniques of juxtaposition, their ways of forcing ideas together in odd ways, a certain ethos of like a dreamlike weirdness, has been thoroughly absorbed by popular culture and even advertising.
Oh, yeah, Avenue, you can find Magritte paintings.
Exactly.
The big casino in Belgium.
So I'm curious how, given that that's part of what's happened, and that in some sense the surrealists kind of aid, they gave tools to those forces today that want to kind of colonize the unconscious. So they're like, hey, these surrealists did a great job of opening up a language of this shadow twilight realm that kind of surrounds us all and filling it with desire, and we're interested in desire, and we're interested in images and sort of shaping people's imaginations. So what does a poor surrealist do in today's climate when some of those tools and strategies and ideas are so clearly part of the kind of, you know, corporate dream machine, if you will?
Well, I would say I would look to people like Annie Lebrun, who is still writing her. We translated and published one of her more recent books called The Reality Overload, which is all about that colonization of the imagination by the forces that are using it to sell things and to repress the act, to colonize the imagination in such a way that it will become predictable, that it will get rid of all those shadowy areas that might pop up with strange combinations they're not equipped to deal with. And it, to me, that's her view of things, and we've talked about this quite a bit, is in this age, you know, the age of manifestos is done. They basically are caricatures of themselves. And she sort of views what she does as a kind of sniper. She finds those areas where the orthodoxy has left its flank unprotected, and then she pounces. She was a member of the Surrealist group the last, Breton was still alive, and her first major book was an attack on feminism for to train the feminist principles of Louise Michel and Virginia Woolf, people like that, so that we could get the sagging feminism of, she called it, of Simone de Beauvoir, or the Jesuitism of Marguerite Duras, the affected mannerisms, and she basically called it pantsuited Stalinism. That the revolutionary impulse of the early feminists had been detoured, or I guess as the situationists would say, deturned. And it was being used by women who were finding places in the power structure such as it is. As she would put it, you know, the original feminists were fighting to disband the army. The modern ones are looking for a way to become enlist.
Well, they just feed into the patriarchal culture that they're fighting against, and they're not actually making any change. It's like they're just feeding the thing that they're trying to kill with their own bodies, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this has been great. We've opened up a lot of questions. We need to take a break here, and so we'll come back for the second half. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with John Graham about surrealism, and we'll be right back.
Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis, talking with John Graham about surrealism and crazy books and all that fun stuff. John, I wonder if you could indulge the listeners a little bit with some of the techniques that you experience. Like you mentioned, one of the ways that they would do it is by playing these games, which to me is one of my favorite things, and I always would enjoy finding out about those things. And you sent me this wonderful CD with all those kinds of things on them and some of the ones that you developed. Can you maybe share, like, what was one of your favorite crazy games that you participated in that really you found really effective for just kind of breaking open your head?
Well, there are a couple. I mean, I started with automatist writing, which does work, but you have to just you just have to divorce the ego from it totally.
Mm.
But it does give you access to the resonance you're looking for, if I can put it that way.
Right.
But one of the things that I found really fascinating, I think it was in the CD I gave you, was that walk game where I and a friend, I was living in Paris, and I gave a friend in New York a map of Paris with a pre-indicated route drawn on it, and he sent me one of New York with the same thing, and then we went out for a walk and using a map for a different city that we obeyed scrupulously. And I found it just after 20 minutes, I was in almost a complete trance. That there was a sense of fighting it, the ego part, the asylum guard, so to speak, was protesting mightily as I was first doing it. But then after a while, it all just made sense, and I was going through areas I knew quite well and areas that I didn't, but the areas I knew quite well were completely new. And I thought that was a lot of fun, actually. And I still am fond of Exquisite Corpses, which is the drawing where you take a piece of paper, fold it in three or four. One person does the first fold, folds it over so the next person drawing can't see what's there, and so on. And then when everybody's contributed, you open it up and you see what's leapt forth, and you can do it with words as well.
Those work, like, every time for me.
It's just
crazy, the results that you get from these.
I mean, the thing about surrealism, and it's what you don't get through the art books, is it was like a Grail Brotherhood that was also had a lot of Monty Python aspects. They were very serious, but they knew how to laugh.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always get I never met Breton. I was too young. But, you know, the word is he was the commissar, the pope. And nothing could be further from the truth. According to everybody, even people that had been excluded from the group, had this just spontaneous reverence, love for this man. And people, I mean, I'd heard repeatedly that he was open to anybody. Young people were always showing up at his place, knock on the door, and he'd talk to them and make an appointment for them to come back later if he was busy. He was just very receptive. He was hardly a pope at all, but that's the image one gets from the art books as the pope of surrealism who, you know, ruled his minions with an iron hand.
Well, and they would participate in communities is the other thing that I have always enjoyed. People think of them as these, like, crazy artists that would just, you know, be completely self-contained or something. But part of the point, if I'm not mistaken, was that they were feeding off of each other's consciousnesses as well and kind of unifying.
Absolutely.
Them. Yeah.
And the French term, which I've never found a satisfying English translation for, is mise en commun de la pensée, which is putting your thoughts together in common.
Oh, that's so good.
And that was the thing, and that's why there were exclusions, because some people wouldn't want to be part of that.
Right.
And it's like, well, you know, it's like love. You can't go through the motions. And it really was, you know, a deep emotional bond between these people, and sometimes they had rifts and ruptures. You know, when Max Ernst was excluded, Andre Breton protested mightily, but some of the younger surrealists insisted, and he went along. I mean, that's not a pope.
Right.
But,
well, and it is that thing. I mean, did you experience any kind of strange things when you kind of went through these things and unified consciousness with a kind of group of people? Like, was there anything crazy that happened?
It's synchronicity seems to get turned on. I mean, it's in the surrealist term is objective chance, but it just seems that it gets dialed to the percentage of strange things happening just goes way off the meter.
Hmm.
You just start. It's like the world is waiting for somebody to look at it with these kind of eyes.
Yeah, that's been my experience too. I mean, when you were talking about the game you played with swapping the maps out, a practice that I like to do when I'm in an unfamiliar city is to sort of put myself in the place as if I was in a dream. Like I'm on the street, I'm in a dream. Like what attracts me? And I start to like tune into very small, odd details. The name of the street reminds me of something, or maybe there's a god, you know, like there's a weird statue in a window, and I'll go towards that, and I'll just operate on the assumption that every little node, the more pregnant with weirdness it is, the more nodes will continue to unfold, and it generally works that way until
I'm really walking
in kind of a dream city, and it's those techniques. I mean, that's part of what's so wonderful about the surrealist, like, affirmation is that those things are right there. You know, they're right next door. The fold is just around the corner. It just requires a different kind of framework. But it's also just really important to recognize how much they were actually practicing with their consciousness in real time. And in one of the other mistakes that the art books do is they always talk about it in terms of Freud. You know, the realists come after Freud. Freud discovers the unconscious. They start to, like, twist it in these different directions and da-da-da-da. And it's like, the thing about that whole notion that Freud discovers the unconscious is totally hooey. The entire 19th century is exploding with people exploring their consciousness in far weirder fashions. Mesmerism, spiritualism, early hypnotism, you know, people are coming up with clairvoyant events, they have different personalities, they're describing languages on other planets, and there's this whole history of actively exploring the sort of shadow regions of the mind, whether you call it the subconscious or the subliminal conscious, there's different names for it. And then Freud, in our, like, conventional story, is like the guy who comes along and, like, does it all, you know, and he discovers this new continent. It's like totally mapped already. There's all sorts of people running in all sorts of different directions. And then when you think about that tradition, then so much of what the surrealists are doing, it makes even more sense. It's like, oh, they're just picking this up and taking it into a more explicitly sort of either daily life and actual art, you know, producing art objects and art events as opposed to, you know, trying to find spirit guides from Mars. But it's the same kind of, there's this rich culture that they're modifying in a 20th century way rather than just riffing on Freud, which doesn't
exist. Oh, absolutely. You mentioned the spirit guides of Mars, and that's Helen Smith.
Yeah.
Theodore Flournoy, who was, you know, precursor to Freud, Charcot, Pierre Janet, they all were working at a more clinical level. But Freud himself, you know, when he was translated into English, they made him much more clinical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love reading him in French because I can't read German, because the id is translated directly from Freud's German, and it's at the Sachi Parle, that talking thing.
That's so good. Well, and a lot of people don't know.
It's the big me.
Yeah.
And there's a super me.
Yeah.
Freud was also studying supernatural phenomenon and spiritualism and all that stuff. And even, like, at the end of his life, he said the one thing he regretted was not studying psychic phenomenon more. Like, he was enthralled by it, and that was the inspiration for, you know, all the stuff he talked about.
Well, that's another example, you know, what Breton was saying about the great man being betrayed by his disciples, you know, and he said for several reasons. One is that the veneration he causes among some, you know, removes, you know, makes them timid. And then the other side is that the envy or anger he creates among those who don't like him animates this whole attack on him and his ideas that completely distort and destroy the original point. I mean, there's this, it's, you know, the for me, the later part of surrealism is very interesting because it's really, it really changed a lot. And it was trying to deal with what, there's this text called Window Wipers by Robert Lebel, who is a friend of Marcel Duchamp, and he was talking about early surrealism. And these are, you know, when he first met them, he thought there was a whole army from what he'd heard in the press. These Bolsheviks that were determined to bring down society and replace it with some strange, savage culture that belonged in New Guinea. And there was only a handful of them. He said, you know, there's, you know, it was a cafe, and there they all were. And these were the people that had the newspapers, you know, slavering and quaking in their boots. And and they were all published by the major publishers, Gallimard, Minuit, all the major publishers of France were publishing all their works. And then he says, now, post-World War II, it's the opposite. Nobody will touch them. You know, the surrealists of our era are forced to heed Marcel Duchamp's prophetic line is that the artists of the future will go underground because the culture no longer is interested in pursuing these people and promoting their ideas.
So where do you see the most lively center, if not explicitly, you know, people who think of themselves as being surrealists with a capital S, but just that spirit, where do you see it happening now in our very different environment, so, you know, overwhelming and apocalypses in every direction and, you know, the digital media? I mean, it's such a strange world that in some ways is like, you know, designed for these kinds of practices and impulses, and in other ways not really wanting to take on what
like
it means.
That are all, you know, there's so many things that without surrealism may not ever have occurred. I would say, I mean, on one level, you know, for an organized group activity, and there are groups still all over the world, small, but the one that's the most effective and the most organized is the one in Prague and Bratislava, and they've been active nonstop since the 30s. And they were, you know, even when I visited there when it was still a communist state, and that was quite a revelation. And at that time, they had no clue that the Russians would ever be gone. And since then, the Velvet Revolution occurred, but they weren't totally looking forward to it. They said the problem with the communist state we live in is that we're all treated like children, and we're not allowed to do things or think for ourselves. But we look at the West, and there's no homelessness here. Nobody's starving, and we think that's a very good thing. And we think that if the Russians were to leave, the Germans and the Americans are going to march right in, and in a few years, we're just going to be a playground for the rich. The areas that we live in that are old Prague will have gotten too expensive. We'll all be driven out to the hinterlands. And you won't be able to go watch the Prague clock at noon anymore without paying for an expensive drink at the German cafe that no doubt will buy up the entire view of it. And all that's come to be.
Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating to me because I have always viewed the surrealists as freedom fighters.
Right. And so it makes sense to me that they, some of the early ones would join the communists just because the philosophy of communism is this idea that everyone should be free to do things. And it obviously it didn't turn out that way most countries in real life. But, and for you too, like I see that a lot in the work that you do and keeping that tradition through publishing a lot of these works that other people, there's no way they would go near them. Like, you know, even just like the sex magic stuff or some of these older things that people seem to have like forgotten about, and that tradition of the Prague surrealists in keeping everything so that they do have the freedom to think, they have that freedom to experience spirituality or religion in their own bodies by themselves without the church. And just how you mentioned early on that you thought surrealism were these kind of like torch holders fighting the, you know, the kind of Christian takeover that's happened and trying to keep these things open and free. And, I mean, how do you view your role in publishing as kind of keeping that tradition?
Well, part of it, I mean, in fact, Paul Hammond has a really good term for it that I'm going to steal. Instead of alter egos, he calls them alter ids.
Mm.
And it's, surrealism always said, in revolt, you have no need of ancestors, and then they promptly pulled out this long line going all the way back to Hermes Trismegistus of the people they viewed as their ancestors.
Huh.
But that was part of the surrealist... it's part of the game. I mean, it's like when they played the game of truth, which, unlike a lot of the surrealist innovations, Madison Avenue never picked up the game of truth. And one famous example was Paul Éluard asking André Breton if he had any friends, and he said, "No, I have no friends, dear friend." But
good.
You know, it's the metaphor I've always sort of looked at. I say it's an unsilvered mirror, because you've got the mirror, but without the silver, it's a piece of glass. So it's a telescope and microscope of Leonard Carrington. You know, you're trying to achieve this balance, and it never lasts forever. But when you can get it, it makes it all worthwhile. When I'm looking for books, I mean, I'm obviously, the mission of Inner Traditions is not my mission. It's you know, we have a specific niche that we're going through. But within that, I'm allowed to find books that I think are important to bring back. I mean, one of the books that we brought back was Hara by Durkheim, which was out of print for years, and a lot of old book dealers are probably cursing my name for bringing it in print because they were selling it for $150 on the Internet, and now it's available again for $15 or $16.
Well, and that's a big deal, because there's so many books that you guys have put out that I've just been like, yes, like ones that I have looked for that seriously cost hundreds of dollars, and then you guys put it out, and I'm like, thank God I can get access to this material.
Well, and that's what I look for. And I go to France, and I haunt not only the publishers that I visit, but I also go looking through all the old books, because in the 19th century, France was just a hotbed of esotericism. And people that followed the Rennes Le Chateau mystery get a sense of it, but only a distorted view. I mean, there was so much going on there with Papus, De Guaita, all these people. And, you know, one of the books that I think I sent you a copy, was The Secret Message of Jules Verne.
Yeah, amazing.
And he was coding Rosicrucian and Freemasonic principles in his books. You know, the underground city is basically the magic flute, transferred to Scotland.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I find things like that, I think I've always been a believer in a return to sources. And in a way, that's sort of the natural impulse of nature itself, is to go back before starting another evolutionary impulse. As it sort of steps back and then pushes forward. But
well, and I think that's a really good description of the esoteric tradition itself, is that the reason that it has these esoteric disciplines is people go back to look at, well, where did all this stuff come from? And with the surrealists, they're taking everything from before, from these old, old traditions, but then incorporating them and making them live again. So, I mean, that whole act is kind of like you become a Dr. Frankenstein, where you take, you know, the old esoteric things and you breathe new life into them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the surrealists were very conscious of that being part of a tradition, but they were also... I think Breton's phrase was they never wanted to shut out the wind from the streets.
Mm.
You know, that, and today that would be rap music or, you know, that's something that a number of surrealist groups that are active now, they're basically just perpetuating themselves as surrealists. But Breton rarely wrote about being a surrealist. Usually he was writing about something else from the surrealist perspective. And he would have been, if he had been alive, he would have, you know, marched into battle with Foucault, Derrida, all of these various people that have been taken over the cultural landscape, different forms of music. He was always very alert to that. And that was one of the things that, for me, made surrealism so interesting, is that it was it was that balancing act again.
Hmm. I mean, you can see it. People a lot of times will look at consciousness culture. I mean, on this show we talk about so much of, you know, consciousness and how it influences cultures and, you know, Burning Man or these different groups and stuff like that. But I think people forget, like, they all want to think like their little movement kind of started on its own and there are these, like, you know, harbingers and there are these revolutionaries, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But I think that's where a lot of the esoteric traditions come in, because it's groups that acknowledge that, oh wait, like, this comes from like way back here, and this thing that I'm doing, this is like a recapitulation of this whole other thing, and you know, if I can use these techniques in a more conscious manner, I can totally just like make it go into everything I'm doing.
Well, you could say the surrealists were saying we didn't build it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah, in that way, I think they present a really, healthy or playful way of dealing with tradition, which I think is one of the big issues with esotericism, and it goes back to the same political question I asked earlier, where there's something very attractive, very powerful, very transformative about a lot of this lore, these practices, these traditions. But there's some unfortunate tendencies there, and there you can see them, and you can see them not just explicitly politically, but just in terms of how people think about tradition or how they identify themselves with positions outside of the culture that we actually live in as a way to escape from the responsibility of being in our moment. And mm-hmm. with the surrealists, you really get a sense of like people who really did their homework, but who also really let all that learning go when the moment of engaging the possibilities of lived experience, even in a modern, crazy, full of street noise, full of political brouhaha culture, and to have the faith that the animating force of those esoteric traditions are always available to remake themselves, to create a new face, a new form, a new expression, rather than being like a capital T tradition that we must adhere to because we're the elite that know the secret, you know, which is a,
right. Well, Breton said, you know, he's only a surrealist until a better thing comes along. You know, he was always ready to jettison it. So there are people that wave the surrealist banner that are extremely dogmatic about it. But, you know, when I was meeting the people that were still around in the 80s when I lived in Paris, they were much older than I was, 70s, 80s, and they were like among the youngest people I ever met. Jean Benoit, from Quebec, he's like the champion of the amorous heresy. And he was the one that in 1959 did the performance of reenacting the Marquis de Sade's will, which never got carried out by his heirs, where he basically said, plant me in some anonymous piece of ground, throw some oak seeds on it, and within a generation people will have forgotten that I ever existed.
Hmm. Well, that's a wonderful image. I think we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind, John.
Oh, you're welcome. This has been fun.
Is there any place you could send people URL, any of your writings, anything online that people want to find out more?
Well, there's Lulu has some stuff in Invisible Heads, which is basically a two-volume chronicle of surrealist activity in the United States for the last 40 years.
All right. Well, that'll have to do for now. So from me and Maj and all you out there, keep your minds open.